How can citizens who are unable to study at university become better citizens equipped with critical and discerning decision-making skills? Should more citizens be encouraged to attend universities to develop these skills and virtues? I very much welcome that question because it does remind me, first of all, that the university can be a privileged environment for the formation of the critical mind, and that not everyone has that privilege. And that therefore, secondly, issues around access, to use the familiar word, are crucial. How are these skills and critical virtues communicated? Universities have got better as time's gone on, I think, about their interaction and outreach with the community. And in my time as a bishop in Wales, I was privileged to sit on the governing body of a very different academic institution, University of Wales College in Newport, an institution profoundly committed to access, an institution which worked intensively and very imaginatively with a deeply deprived and depressed region of South East Wales, making it possible for some of these skills to be developed. And I think that that is part of the answer. Universities need to work repeatedly at that issue of access. Sadly, we're often confronted with what I think is a false antithesis between access and excellence in higher education. I don't think that's a necessary standoff, but working it through is not easy. But I welcome the question. I think that widening of university access within the framework of some clear understanding that what you're trying to produce is not simply people with qualifications, but people with qualities, I think that we ought to be working at, definitely. One of my tutors was fond of saying that the most interesting figures in the history of ideas were those who turned out to be wrong. How might universities encourage the excellence of being wrong? That's a lovely question. And I think the answer is partly that a university ought not to see itself as primarily a risk-free, sanitized intellectual environment. The history of our intellectual life in this country, in Europe more generally, in the world at large, is of course a history of risk-taking. The history of science is a history of risk-taking. There would have been absolutely no advance in science at any point had people not been willing to make fools of themselves, to offer wrong answers to questions that nobody else seemed to be asking, but which needed asking. So I think there's a very considerable place for being wrong in university life. Heaven help us if the first consideration of any working intellectual is, how can I be absolutely sure I'm not making a mistake? That's a recipe for absolute stasis. Can you say more about the skills, dispositions, and virtues of the teacher in the university context from a theological perspective? There's been some quite interesting writing about this in recent years, and I would say that the skills of a teacher are primarily those of a learner, by which I mean a good teacher is somebody who has not finished with his or her subject, and whose engagement in communicating it is part of their own exploration, which is why I think a glib and facile separation between teaching and research will never be for the good of any university or any intellectual institution. A good teacher is a good learner, who in communicating what he or she loves and is committed to is themselves developing. And that means, of course, a good teacher is a good listener as well as a good speaker. Someone who is prepared to learn even from their students. When I look back on nearly 20 years of university teaching in my own life, I can, without exaggeration, point to perhaps four or five moments when students of mine have said things to me that have actually changed my perspective for good at all. Not necessarily even that they have argued me out of a position, but that simply by coming to a field, a subject, new to them, but just a little bit stale to me, have made me think afresh. And my most vivid memory of that kind is one of my students now, a very distinguished cleric in the Church of England, saying to me as I was trying to explain a theological point to him, "But why is that a problem?" And he was absolutely right to ask that. I'm still asking about that particular subject. In other words, it's a problem. Why it's a problem. But that's some of what I'd say about the virtues of the teacher. And from a theological perspective, more specifically, I think that in the New Testament, there is, let's say in the letters of Paul especially, a wonderful kind of shot silk, double-sided portrayal of the Christian teacher, who is also in communicating truth, discovering it. I sometimes used to say to my students that St. Paul didn't know he was writing the New Testament. And so his argumentation is not tidy, and his prose is convoluted. I'm always happy to recognize a fellow sufferer. And he is, so to speak, feeling his way into a deeper understanding of the truth as he communicates. Because his primary sense of what his duty is as a teacher is to let truth be in him. Not to describe it, categorize it, or imprison it, but to let it be. And theologically, I'd say that's where teaching begins. Can truth find a home here and be alive? Which relates a little bit to a question, a nice simple question that I had here. Do you believe in ultimate truth? And the answer is yes. I don't believe that the world is simply the construct of what we choose. I don't believe that the world is a kind of minimal agreement about what we can just about manage together. I believe the world, because it comes from the hand of an absolutely real God, the world is thus and not otherwise. And that, therefore, education is always education in reality, in knowing how to relate to a truth, a reality, and a life which doesn't change as we do. But it's precisely because I do believe in ultimate truth that I'm wary of premature attempts to say, "And we've now got it," because of its solidity and infinity, its glory, I'll use the word again, we have to be very cautious about supposing that we have it now wrapped up, though we can believe it draws us and compels us and has authority over us. Take a slightly different one. Why does society find it easier to admire excellence in sport, arts, etc., than excellence of the mind? Good question. And I guess it was ever so, though there are societies other than ours which seem to be a little bit more generous to the life of the mind than we sometimes are. But I wonder if it's something to do with the sheer fact of performance. You know what it looks like for somebody to be good at sport. You know what it looks like for somebody to be a great artist? What does it look like for somebody to be a great mind? Imagine a great mind, but all you can think of is probably some bloke sitting in a study somewhere, looking slightly pained. As performance goes, that's not very exciting. And I wonder, we are a very image-obsessed and performance-focused culture, aren't we? And I suspect it may have just a little bit to do with that. There's a cluster of questions which look as if they're in the same handwriting, which are generally, very interestingly, about faith and evidence and good arguments. And how far do you think reason and science should approach religion and the question of God's existence? God is outside time and space. Why would he care about us who live in such a minute part of it? If God cannot be demonstrated with evidence, in what sense could he be said to exist? Isn't it avoidance of argument to say it's down to faith? In all sorts of areas of our human life, we make commitments that are not absolutely compelled by evidence. We do what the late great philosopher Julian Rose called staking ourselves. There is enough to make us feel compelled or drawn by something, to say, here I must be, and I take the risk of moving into that space where I'm committed. It's not peculiar to religious faith. The religious faith is a particularly sharp and, if you like, extravagant form of it. And that means that when we look academically at what faith is all about, two things at least are going on. One is the very general work of mapping out some of those things in the human world that do, as a matter of fact, rightly or wrongly, draw people to the edge of commitment. What are the sorts of argument and the sorts of experience that impel people to the edge of commitment? We can at least look at how that happens. And then we can look at how people argue when they are committed. How do they draw conclusions about the divine and the interaction of the divine with the human world? What do their arguments look like when they are committed? And in between those two moments is, of course, that inaccessible and mysterious moment of transition when you make the commitment, when there is a choice. And while the academic analysis can say quite a lot about what happens on the way to that and what happens after it, there remains, somewhere in the middle, something which does resist sheerly academic study. I hope that's not too evasive an answer, because, as I say, I think it's not quite as uncommon a feature of our human existence as we might think, if we have a rather simplistic view that we always act when the evidence has stacked up and we can say, all right, there's really no decision to be made, that's the obvious thing to do. In how many areas of our lives, or even our intellectual lives, do we actually work like that? Not all of them. Which is why I said that quite a lot of what goes on in the university is actually the study of things that are not wholly unlike religious faith.